Hello, I'm Claire Armitstead. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Erase from podcast app.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast, an alternative fact-free zone where we gleefully won't delete what made John Mullen blush so. There are no two ways about it. To encounter Pulitzer Prize-winning Michael Chabon is to enter a universe that stretches the normal rules of physics.
The world contains both Batman and Auschwitz.
And that's how Michael Chabon began his journey in the year 2000 with The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. He's never one to shy away from the complexities of life, as he describes, with John on hand to deliver some appropriately off-script sound effects.
Part of what I wanted to do in this book was to celebrate and glorify the power of the imagination as a problem-solving tool for human existence, and one of those problems being the nature of existence itself.
Chabon immerses us in the late 1930s, a time when fascism was on the march in Europe and when America was simultaneously reveling in the golden era of comic books, hence Batman and Auschwitz. We're introduced to Joseph Cavalier, who has smuggled himself out of occupied Prague in a coffin and ends up slumped like a question mark against the doorframe in the Brooklyn bedroom of his cousin Sam Clay. They strike up a partnership in comic books and together invent The Escapist, a superhero whose power would be that of impossible and perpetual escape. When Cavalier and Clay won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000, it was described as a masterwork by one of America's finest writers. 17 years later, Michael Chabon joined John Mullen for a Guardian Live book club event with a novel that is still dear to our hearts, but how well would its author recall it?
We'll be testing you, Michael, a bit against authors who've done this before, some of whom have been good at remembering their own books, some of whom you can explore the podcast archive maybe a little harder.
I probably should have reread it.
Well,
many academics write a list at the end of their books stating which archives they've visited for research, though it has to be said it's not so usual for a novel, and certainly not such a very long list. So John began by asking, what did you have to go to all those archives for?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that unusual that novelists turn to libraries for help with research. And, you know, the New York Historical Society Library, you know, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what I went there hoping to find, but I think it was mostly just photographs from the period that I was writing about. And what I was looking for would be photographs of everyday street scenes and things, so I could get a look at people's shoes and handbags and, you know, just to try to get a more of a sense than you get from watching movies from the period where it's always going to be the costume designer's sort of notion of contemporary dress. And in any case, you know, I think most writers have at some point or another are going to turn to research archives of some kind or another to write their books, but maybe what's less common is thanking those institutions. And I think it's something I've learned from John Irving, actually. I noticed that John Irving's, I didn't learn it from him personally, I don't know him, but I just noticed that in his books he often would have an acknowledgments, and it made sense to me. And I do have a sense of gratitude to these places and institutions. You're so grateful that such a place even exists and they bothered to hold on to all this material, whatever it is. It seemed appropriate to express that gratitude.
It's funny you should mention looking at photographs, because I think that's one really striking thing about this novel, actually. There's an example which leaps into my mind when Thomas, age 11, goes into Manhattan for his regular secret meeting with Joe.
Kind of remember this.
Kind of remember this. But this is you're kind of seeing it through his eyes. And, you know, there's a page or two which kind of, I suppose, must be born out of your experience of looking at photos and things. But it's just a fantastic, I think of it as a very sort of Chabon-esque thing. It's a fantastic assemblage of impressions, really. And there are buckles on shoes. Buckles on shoes, I'm sure, is one of them.
I think there's glints. There's that thing about different things that are
you
glinting.
See, you do remember it. You do.
It's coming back to me now.
Uh-huh. And that's a kind of... And there's, look, but where do you get the smells from? Because there's lots of smells in your book.
Yeah, libraries are not really good at collecting smells.
It's very old-fashioned, weak spot, your novel.
Well, I mean, I have a keen sense of smell, and it's, you know, as with most people, it's supposedly smell is the sense that's most tied to memory. In a way, I almost have kind of an olfactory imagination, and so part of my trying to imagine myself into a scene, and particularly a scene that I haven't actually directly experienced, like New York in the 1950s, is sort of try to imagine how it might have smelled, and I'll think, well, what would be some of the sources of odor around, whether it was a tar-making boiler that was because they're resurfacing a street or something, and try to latch on to possible smells. And then also, if I'm researching, if I'm reading, you know, other writers of the time, contemporary writers setting something in the 1940s, that Irwin Shaw short story, so maybe, you know, might mention the smell of roasting chestnuts from a chestnut vendor, something like that. And just, you know, I'll take notes while reading. If I'm working on a book, anything that comes my way, I'll note it and try to employ it.
There's a great bit when Sam gets back, when he's living in the suburbs. He's married to Rosa, and he gets back, and it's, I can't remember whether it's through her impressions or his, actually. I can't remember that, but it's got sort of, he's got all the smells he's brought back on him.
On him, like a transcript of his day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I notice about people.
Yes.
and for good and ill. And, you know, when I walk into a room, when I walk into a setting, when I'm in a city, actually, I feel when I got into London there, I'm not necessarily sure I could name them exactly, but there is a characteristic smell. Maybe it's the river that I associate with London that comes back to me when I get here again. And I'll stop noticing it after the first couple of minutes. It goes away, but it's there. So.
And it's a sort of, if somebody hadn't read this novel or other novels by you, the fact of these sense impressions, I suppose, might be something I would think of in order to... I would describe them as being kind of characteristic of the way you write, because this novel is very... It's kind of copious, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's full of stuff. And there are lots of novelists around who say, oh, the whole point of novels is cut things down.
I do cut things down. This would have been four times longer if I
really
cut it down.
But you do like abundance, don't you?
I just can't help it.
Yeah.
No, I'm always taken aback. Like, with this most recent book, with Mungo, I had the impression that I didn't use very many similes. I thought I was working hard to keep similes out, because I have a tendency to use a lot of similes and metaphors. And much to my surprise, people just kept pointing out all these similes, and I realized I hadn't done a good job at all keeping similes. I just can't help it. It's and one of the reviews I remember of Cavalier and Clay said, you know, this well written, etc. But I counted 17 different similes for the color of the sky, the blue of the sky. You know, do we really need 17 different similes for the color, comparing this color of the sky to various things? And my answer was yes.
Yes.
I mean, because it's what does blue tell you?
So it's Dickens and fog and you and the sky.
Exactly.
I mean, funny you mention reviewers, because after I kind of read it and thought about what the things were that I noticed, I looked at a couple of reviews. And one of the things, which is another part, I guess, of what I'd call a sort of the abundant aspect of your writing and your sentences, actually, is there's lots of fantastic words in it. And I noticed that some of the other reviewers, probably all had the same academic training as me, I fear, had also made the lists of these words, you know, which are kind of, I'll mispronounce it, mucilage, is that how you pronounce it?
Mucilage.
Mucilage. Mm-hmm. Prognathus. Mm-hmm. Epinephrine.
What?
Right. It's here.
What is it?
My pronunciation.
No, you made that up.
Yeah, no.
Well, then I made that up.
No. Did you make up itatoria?
Itatoria.
Yeah, did you make that up?
Yes.
Oh. I knew you did.
But it's a good one.
Sort of golden agey.
It means golden agey.
Yeah, golden ages. It should exist, shouldn't it?
It should exist.
Oh, yes.
And now it does. No one's ever used it again, but maybe they will someday.
Has it got into...
The nonce word for the nonce.
But it might have got into dictionaries, and then it starts...
I hope so.
Yeah, okay.
If Shakespeare can do it.
Well, and Coleridge and lots of people. Mm-hmm. Why not you? I mean, I'm sorry. I don't want to detain you.
But epinephrine.
Epinephrine. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's in an EpiPen.
Okay.
That's what Epi's...
Oh, right, okay.
It's adrenaline.
Nystagmus.
Nystagmus.
That means something funny in your... Okay.
Walleye.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you like doing all that, don't you? You like all this.
I like to know the right word.
Yes.
For something, yeah. What was the other one there before epinephrine?
Prognathus.
Oh, prognathus, yes.
Okay.
A protruding lower jaw.
Yes.
You saved two words by saying...
Okay. No, I agree. I agree. Mm-hmm. And I have to... Some of the other reviewers... caught out words which I thought, oh, come on, I know that word.
Yeah, that's. I mean, everyone has, that's the thing about people commenting or criticizing you for using fancy words or whatever, because everyone has words they consider to be
I'm not criticizing, I love it.
Oh, no, I know you're...
I relish it. When you're writing this novel, we talk about the research, but it feels as if there were two or three things, ideas, that almost came before the novel. Is that true? Or the idea of the escapology and the interest in this particular period of American history and in the comic books? Mm-hmm. Well, must have been quite a powerful impetus.
I mean, I think the period came first.
Yeah.
And it came first because I've always been drawn to that period. Since, I mean, really, truly, among the first things I can remember is... a restaurant, we lived in Phoenix, Arizona, I was about 3 years old, and there was a restaurant that had and it was an older restaurant, and it had a case where the cash register was at the front that was full of cigars, with these gaudy cigar boxes lined up in this case, and candy bars to the side. And I can remember understanding at this age that there were no other restaurants that had this, and I understood, maybe somebody told me this was sort of a survival from a past where restaurants commonly sold cigars for gentlemen, you know, as they were leaving premises, wanted to have a cigar. So, and I had this understanding, this is a relic, this box kind of contains the recent past in a way that was alluring to me. You know, my dad grew up in Brooklyn, New York in the 1930s and 40s, and he reminisced a lot to me, and he sort of created or recreated his childhood for me through his stories. It was always a very vivid time and place for me. The popular culture, the movies, the music, the games that kids played in the street, and just New York City from that era always interested me. And I always had this sort of longing to see it for myself, like a wish I could travel there and experience it directly, which of course is impossible, but it's possible through writing about it and researching it and all of those things. And then that conjoined with my stumbling across a magazine article from, I think, Smithsonian Magazine or something, that had a piece about Siegel and Shuster, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the two kids from Cleveland, Ohio, who created the character of Superman in the 1930s. And, you know, just that article came together with my yearning to see New York during that period when Superman was invented, and they just, you know, thought, okay, this is going to be my time machine. This is going to be the way I can travel back. You know, I'd always sort of thought maybe I would like to write something set during that time, but I could never really come up with the appropriate or interesting vehicle to do it in. And then comics gave me that. And there was also kind of an olfactory component to it too, because I had also had been for a while been thinking about doing something with comic books, and I wasn't sure what, and I didn't think of it in terms of a historical or period piece, but I had this box of comics, the surviving box from my childhood collection. I had sold all the other ones to another kid when I was about 15 years old, and I held on to this one box that were comics that had been drawn by Jack Kirby, who was great. Maybe like,
is he the Captain America guy?
Yes, among many, many other characters. I mean, almost all the major Marvel characters, with the exception of Spider-Man, he had some hand in creating. He's kind of like the, if not Shakespeare, you know, the Cervantes. He is just a primal figure in the history of comic books and a great genius. And I had always loved his work. I held on to this box, but I never opened it. I didn't read the comics. It was taped up. And I just moved it with me for years. And then one day we were packing to move yet again. This is sometime in the early 90s. And I guess I was just procrastinating. I didn't feel like packing. And I opened the box up and this smell of old comic books kind of came pouring out of the box. And it really pulled on something inside me. I had this kind of ache that I felt, and that maybe, you know, nostalgia, this is for my own past or for something, but it was so powerful and potent. I had this sense like there's going to be something I can write at some point about comic books in some way, and then all of those elements came together and determined me to try to write this book.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
It's strange reading about this period of history if you're a British reader, because British novelists, quite often living British novelists, like to set novels in 30s, 40s, 50s. Mm-hmm. But for most British novelists, that sort of signifies repression, really, which British novelists
austerity.
Love, you know. And that's sort of, you know, people who can't say things, can't do things, aren't allowed to do
brief
things.
Encounter.
Yes, kind of like the or paradigm. Atonement, you know, or Sarah Waters novels or something like that. But
I've
in America, it's a, it
really.
Feels like ebullience and sort of peculiarly, it's quite important in this novel, isn't it, that whilst the horrors of the European war are taking place, here you are with the characters who are, you know, have a really pressing interest in that, and yet you're in a place and a time where of kind of apparently optimism, energy, possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Right, and no real intention of getting involved in the Second World War, and with Pearl Harbor a couple of years away, and in the sense that history, the focal point or the fulcrum of history, had really kind of shifted to New York City. I mean, and you see this in contemporary accounts of New York, and you can, when I was reading, you know, going through old New Yorker magazines and just reading the front section that's called Talk of the Town, which is sort of this weekly, in a sense, a kind of weekly journal.
Yeah, it's still there, isn't it?
It's still there. Yeah. It used to be more of a journal in a way than it is now, where it was literally the talk of the town. It would say, you know, King Zog of Albania was was staying at the Plaza Hotel this week, and we dropped in to talk to him or whatever. And there is this exuberance and a slight smugness, maybe too, but it was, you know, it's infectious. It was unmistakable, and it was definitely part of the fun. And, you know, the great swing bands were just all peaking right about this period, and so American music was becoming this kind of cultural powerhouse that it, you know, became increased even more in the post-war years. But it's just it was exhilarating.
Yeah, it's strange. I always get a sort of strange feeling when I sort of find out that, you know, the film of Pride and Prejudice with Laurence Olivier and and Greer Garson was filmed in 1941. You know, what are you doing that?
Hey, how can you be making movies at a time like that?
Yes.
Or movies that aren't about war.
No, but sort of, you know, feel good and frivolous. But then your novels sort of brings together, and I guess this is the daring stroke of it, that it brings together, just as the two main characters in what they do bring together, comics and the Holocaust, basically, come together. Mm-hmm. Although the latter is always kind of rumoured rather than...
Yeah, that's offstage.
Yes. Uh-huh. Did you hesitate a bit about that kind of incongruity, or was that what made
it
interesting?
No, I mean, and also I have to say, you know, Art Spiegelman had gotten there first with an actual comic book about the Holocaust. So, you know, he's the one who really transgressed or broke the taboo or whatever it might have been. You know, all I was writing about were people alive at the time that this is happening and who are also in the comic book business. But, I mean, I think that's... The world contains both Batman and Auschwitz. You know, it's part of the same world. And there's a continuum. Mm. They're not discontinuous. They're not unrelated. They don't exist in separate realms. They exist in the same realm. And GIs who were, let's say, signed up in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor or were drafted and were busy reading Superman comic books were the same men who then, you know, liberated Buchenwald. you know, the same consciousness that was feeding itself on a diet of comic books, which were freely distributed to U.S. troops throughout the war as part of their kind of kit of reading material they were given, were then confronted with the horrors and with their horror of their own mortality and the combat that they were asked to engage in. So, you know, it all belongs on the same page together as far as I'm concerned, because it all happened in the same world to the same people in the same consciousnesses.
But it has a consequence too, doesn't it, for the telling of your story, in that there is a kind of doom settled over, especially in the first half of the novel, mm-hmm. over what's going to happen to Joe's family. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a very striking bit early on when you go back in time and they've gone to the ghetto, haven't they? But he gets back into the house and he sees all these carefully packed boxes mm-hmm. and thinks for a moment, oh, that's the kind of incredibly organised mm-hmm. tendency that's going to kind of make my parents survive. And then he thinks, oh, no, it's not. It's mm-hmm. not going to matter at all. Mm-hmm. But there's also the doom that settles over. I mean, there's the whole of the effort. I'm just trying to work out how I knew this would happen, but I knew that in all the efforts to get his younger brother out mm-hmm. and to get on the ship, mm-hmm. that's doomed. I sort of know that's mm-hmm. doomed. Am I supposed to know that's doomed?
Yeah, I mean, I think statistically.
Yes. But I also likely. Know, even when the ship's in Lisbon, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, so much so that I sort of Googled about whether it might be based on something, which it isn't.
No. Yeah, I mean, what interested me and what still interests me is part of what I wanted to do in this book was to celebrate and glorify the power of the imagination as a problem-solving tool for human existence, and one of those problems being the nature of existence itself, and its oft-frequent, you know, misery and despair and brutality. And the way that this team, this duo of young men who are both confined and constrained and imprisoned and enchained in various ways by guilt and by societal norms and by their own limitations and by the weight of history and so on, manage to sort of dream their way out of it in a sense, and that they create this character who is in himself an escape artist, and to celebrate the power of escapism and the power of the idea of escape and the possibility for escape that literature, including comic books, affords us. But at the same time, I also wanted to acknowledge, because you have to acknowledge, the limitations of that power and the fact that imagination is always going to come up against certain finite boundaries beyond which it cannot go. And you know that Superman is impossible, ultimately. And if he were possible, every time he gave Lois Lane a hug, he would crush her to death. You know, right? I mean, there's a quote that's an epigraph for the novel that's something that Will Eisner, the great comic book artist, Will Eisner said to me when I was interviewing him as I was beginning this book, and he said it apropos of, I had asked him if he thought there was any particular reason why there were so many Jewish kids in comic book business, and it had led to the creation of Superman and so many other superhero characters, and did he think there was something in their Jewishness that led to the creation of the superhero as we know it? And at first he kind of dismissed the question. He said, you know, no, I mean, it was just a simple economic thing. If you were a Jewish kid and you wanted to make your living drawing or even writing, most of the kind of big commercial possibilities were close to you, like the advertising agencies wouldn't hire Jewish artists. And the big slick magazines that ran lots of illustrations and had illustrated covers and painted covers and so on wouldn't hire Jews. And so if you wanted to make your living doing that kind of art, commercial art, comics were the only game in town. And that they would hire you. I mean, most of the comic book companies were owned by Jews. Mm. And that was part of the reason. But then he kind of paused and he said, but no, actually, now that you mention it, I mean, maybe there's something, for example, in the story of the Golem of Prague. And I had just written the Golem of Prague into the book about right. 2 days before this conversation. I was so excited that he mentioned the Golem. And then he said, we have this history of impossible solutions to insoluble problems. I thought that was beautiful and true, but also, like, don't forget, he said insoluble problems and impossible solutions. There's a beauty in the irrepressible, undeniable power of the imagination, but there's also a built-in failure. You know, there's a built-in impossibility, and you know that results in things like the death of Thomas Cavalier.
The golem is a, I'm glad you mentioned it, because that's, I mean, that does become a metaphor in the novel, doesn't it? And the analogy between the golem, you know, that brilliant bit early on in the novel where he escapes in the sort of coffin with the golem, and fantastic. And this weird story, which I'm afraid I did Google, you know, which is fascinating. Of
it's okay to Google. You don't need to apologize. Everyone does it.
Okay,
it's like masturbation.
I ban my students from doing it.
I see.
I know they do
Do you let them masturbate?
No. Didn't pursue that analogy. Okay. I've erased from podcast that. but it actually became the analogy between the golem and the cartoon. It goes through Joe's head, I think, at one stage in the novel.
That's how the golem got into the book. Was I didn't set out to have it be some kind of, you know, metaphorical examination of the history of Jewish imaginary problem solving. It was, I had this guy that for some reason I had decided to have be a refugee, an immigrant from Prague. And, you know, there is no real historic precedent for that. None of the sort of important, none of the important comic book creators were refugees, as far as I know. It wasn't like I was basing this on any real life person. I'm not entirely sure why I made that choice. And then having made the choice that he's going to be a refugee, I had to come up with a place he could be from. And the timing of the story and the like, sort of gap between the creation of Superman, the first publication in, I think, June 1938, and the entry of the United States into World War II in December 1941, I had this timeline I had to work within, and September didn't work September 39, so I couldn't make him from Poland, so I had to roll it back a little bit, and then I came up against March 1939, the annexation of Czechoslovakia, and I thought, okay, he's going to be from Prague. I've actually been to Prague once. You know, maybe that'll make it
it's
a little easier.
It's all coming together.
And if I said Krakow, then what would I do? So I have this guy, I say he's a refugee, I say he's just showed up, I say he's from Prague, I say he's never seen a comic book before in his life. He's thrust a copy of Superman, he quickly scans it, and then he's told, draw a superhero. And I thought, what would he draw? And I thought, well, he's from Prague, and the golem is kind of like a superhero. And in fact, there are some superheroes in comics subsequently who are sort of analogous, even much more than Superman is, to the golem, like the Human Torch. The original Human Torch was an android, and the Vision in Marvel Comics is an android. So these like artificial created humans who are meant to be heroic figures. There is a kind of golem tradition in comics, a little bit hidden. So I thought, okay, that's what he would draw, the Golem of Prague. And that was as simple as that. But as soon as I thought that, then I thought, oh, this is actually, I can use this. And then I was confronted with the question of how did he get out of Prague? I mean, these things, I'm going back trying to remember decisions I made a long time ago, but I think it was just sort of a natural progression of who would get you out of Prague. It would take some kind of, maybe like a magician or something. And, you know, all these things came together. And before I knew it, I had this whole setup with Kornblum, the magician, and him taking magic lessons. And it was a series of accidents, really, in a way, that then in hindsight came to seem like...
You make the invention of narrative sound a bit like escapology, that you're kind of finding solutions.
I'm always... Yeah. It's always on the fly, just, just very much impromptu. You know, I don't figure things out ahead of time. I don't make outlines, generally speaking, or if I do, I make very rough outlines that I usually end up abandoning or redrafting maybe many times in the course of doing a book. I can't know too much in advance or I lose interest.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So to keep my interest up, I have to be relatively ignorant, which then means I waste a lot of time and I pursue a lot of blind alleys. And this book, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of pages of middle. There's, in a way, this book has no middle. Like, it goes up to midpoint of the Second World War when we sort of last see Joe in Antarctica.
Yeah.
It's like 1943, I think. And then when we rejoin our characters, it's after the war, and there's this gap. Well, the reason there's a gap, there didn't used to be a gap.
I was going to celebrate the cunningness of that gap.
It was It was cunning for me to cut it all.
Yeah.
That was the cunning. Uh-huh. I mean, I tried various things, you know, homecomings and post-homecomings and sort of early post-war life and before the move to the suburbs. There was no story in it somehow. There were characters and there were interactions.
And you wrote it?
Wrote hundreds of pages of it. But it just, I don't know, as soon as I took it out, it felt right. It felt better. And then I had to account for these missing years. Yeah. And then this idea of Joe hiding himself, first sort of disappearing and then coming back but not telling anyone in the Wakefield, the Hawthorne story, Wakefield, where the man who walks out of his door one day and moves into a house around the corner, but doesn't tell his wife and lives around the corner from his wife for 20 years and then comes back one day with no explanation. It's something that's such a beautiful, mysterious story. Paul Auster has written about it too. And that just presented itself as kind of this escape act that Joe tries to pull and is unable. In the end, he gets sort of drawn back in and confined in the box of the woman that loves him and the child that he's never known. And this sort of these crisscrossing plot lines of Joe getting into the box and Sam getting out of the box at the end. And they've changed places, which I realized at some point along the way was the very nature of the first magic act that Houdini came up with. That was kind of an original magic act. It's mentioned in the first pages of the book, the metamorphosis trick where he and his wife would swap places and he would be put into a box, and then when the curtain was lifted, she was in the box and he was out of the box. And you know, so that seemed like the perfect thing, but first I had to get them to change places.
So in this process of setting yourself problems in a way and then trying to solve them or escape from them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a metaphor for the whole of the book. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting because talking, over the years, I've had a few people in the back of this cab and it's convinced, but essentially they're almost kind of two kinds of successful novelists. They're the ones who the plan is everything, that comes first. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are the escapologists in a way. And they're, they're kind of equal camps, I think, numerically almost, but they're definitely one or the other, I think.
Well, I mean, I can't plan. As soon as I start planning, it kills the interest for me, it kills the book for me. But on the other hand, the other way of doing it, the way that I do it, is wildly inefficient and very painful often. And there's a moment I would get to in the writing of almost every book, this one and all the ones after it, where I feel stuck. I can't get out. And there's an episode that is described in Cavalier and Clay that's taken straight from the career of Harry Houdini. It happened here in London at the Hippodrome Theatre, the old Hippodrome Theatre, where he essentially couldn't get out. He was in the Brahma locks, the famous Brahma.
The double box, Brahma.
The double Brahma.
The double Brahma.
And nested double Brahma. And it was the mirror challenge. And he had said that he had told in the mirror that he would be able to get out of these supposedly unbreakable locks. And apparently what happened, I mean, some people think the whole thing really was still a put on.
Yes.
And that he never was truly stuck. But at least the usual story is that he was stuck and he couldn't get out. And it was only through the intervention of his wife who contrived to pass him the key, either by kissing him or in a glass of water that he asked for, that he was able to, he cheated and he escaped in that way. And that is actually, now that I think about it, it's a very appropriate metaphor for what typically happens for me when I get stuck in those Brahma locks and I feel like I really can't get out, is it's usually my wife
brings you the key.
Brings me the key, and that's usually it's just through first whining, whinging, as you call it here, and moaning and complaining and kvetching and saying, like, what am I going to do? And I don't know why I ever thought I was going to do this stupid book in the first place. And then, talking, well, maybe I could do this, or could I just throw out that whole middle section? And, and with her sort of bolstering my confidence and making suggestions and batting away other suggestions, saying, no, don't do that, that'd be wrong, that I usually can find my way out of it and actually find my way out back to a certain degree of enthusiasm to carry on. Like, oh, I'm actually excited about this again. Thank you.
Well, that brings me aptly to my last question, which is, therefore, perhaps you've answered it already about the ending. I'm delighted when I first read the novel to see this. I've got a little collection in my head of novels whose last word is the title of the novel.
Wow.
Yes.
How many others are there?
There are about, I've written them down, I can't remember them all, but there's about six or seven, Heart of Darkness, Beloved. There's a few.
Right. Well, House of Usher, Fall of the House of Usher is not a novel, but I think.
No, it's only novels get into it, but your, yours has got into it. And it's, of course, one of the neat things about ending with the title, there's a John Banville novel which won the Booker Prize called The Sea, which ends with the words, the sea. Mm-hmm. It was as if I were walking into, and then you get it, you go, the sea, and you go, yes, of course. And there is that slight yes, of course, and it always makes it sort of rounded off. But does what you say imply that you didn't always know where it was going to end, how it was going to end, with Joe coming back, Sam going, and rearrangement? You didn't know.
No, I did not know that. I mean, it might possibly have been among the range of possibilities that I vaguely considered in some form. But I mean, typically, even to the extent that I do make an outline, it's very loose and very vague, and I will often get to what I thought was going to be the end or the last few beats on that outline and look and just be like, what was I thinking? Like, no, that can't possibly be what happens. I don't even have this character in the book anymore, so how can that be? But and then I will have to think, well, what is the right ending for this? I have a tendency to, especially when like completing a draft, to try to wrap things up too fast, to sort of think, there, it's done, it's over, the book's over, and then either on my own or with a response I read from my wife, say, no, it's not, you need a little more. Like, take it another scene further, take it another beat further, or just to get the ending wrong, completely wrong sometimes, and there's a certain impatience or just fatigue with the characters that makes me just want to be sort of quit, you know, be rid of them. That didn't happen with this one, and this one, when I got to the end, I was pretty clear as I got to it on what was going to happen, but not beforehand, right. No. And I didn't actually, the last thing that I wrote in this book are the first three pages.
Oh, really?
The opening of the book that said, it used to start something like, one night Sammy's mother told him to move over and make room in the bed for his cousin from Prague, it's the opening sentence of the second section of the first chapter now. But that's how the book started. And I think as I finished this book, and I had been working on it for such a long time, I had a sense of, in a way, that these characters had become real enough to me that I felt like, well, if these were real men and they really had had this storied career and created this somewhat forgotten but important character and had done all this interesting work, I probably wouldn't start a book about them this way. I would probably start the book about them with more of an overview, in the way that documentaries will typically start with all the famous rock musicians who tell you how influential this person you've never heard of was on their work. And, to give that, to start this book with a reader saying, here's not just some guy named Sammy and his cousin. These are important men who did something important. Let me tell you a little bit about who, let me give you a sense that this is an important story and this with this pretense that it's real. So I wanted to start with this sort of in later years, to tell you he was well known, that he went to conventions, he had fans, Sam Clay. There was a history that he was often asked about and he had standard answers that he would give to this history to sort of create that sense of sort of non-fictional significance to the characters that you're going to be reading about. And also to maybe wrong foot the reader just a little bit. And especially in this, not pre-Google era, but in an era where people resorted less readily to Google, to sort of maybe begin to create the slight doubt in a reader's mind about just how much, maybe I don't really know that much about comic books. Really was a comic book.
No, I did do a bit of falling into a bit of those.
Yes.
Trying to spot which ones were real. And
sometimes it worked. Yeah. It worked better with some people than I had really intended. And after the book came out, more than one person approached me to know where they could purchase some Joe Cavalier artwork, and so on. So, I mean, that made me happy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it made me a little worried both for those people's... going through the world, their sort of gullibility, and also just, you know, that I didn't mean to cheat any. I wasn't trying to, not to that extent, to trick anyone.
Yeah, like the bishop who read Gulliver's Travels when it first came out and said, personally, he didn't believe a word of it.
Exactly, exactly.
The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is published by Fourth Estate. Many thanks to Michael Chabon and John Mullen. Next week, we explore the concept of home with Yagyasi and Chibundu Anuzo. For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.